Our guests this morning are Dr. Thomas Cowan and Dr. Andrew Kaufman. Dr. Thomas Cowan went to Duke University, graduated 77, summa cum laude, degree in biology, went to the Peace Corps, and he got involved with the Weston Price work and also the work of Rudolf Steiner. Medical practice for a long time. He's given countless lectures and workshops throughout the country on a variety of subjects. He has his own business that he does with his wife and two sons, Dr. Cowan's Garden. He does these high-quality vegetable powders, kitchen staples, and drtomcowan.com, where he has all kinds of information, webinars, and things like that, that you can join him there. Dr. Andrew Kaufman is an MD. He's a natural healing consultant, inventor, public speaker, forensic psychiatrist, and expert witness. He completed his psychiatric training at Duke University Medical Center after graduating from Medical University in South Carolina. He studied molecular biology, BS, MIT, and he's done all kinds of original research and lectured, supervised, and mentored medical students. And he and Dr. Cowan on the forefront of this idea of Show Me the Virus, and which is the title of our show this morning. We are going to be joined by two gentlemen who have been on the forefront of this whole idea of Show Me the Virus. And you'll see Andrew Kaufman here. Dr. Kaufman, good morning.
Good morning, Patrick.
Nice to talk to you. And then we also have, through the magic of whatever we have going on here, is Dr. Tom Cowan. Oh, hello, Dr. Cowan.
Hey there, Patrick. Good to talk to you again.
Nice to talk to you. So let's get all three of us together here and say hello. Now, gentlemen, I was kind of looking and thinking about the idea that, back in the Middle Ages, when I think it was Aristotle and Pythagoras came up with the idea that, the Earth is really round and not flat, that they probably did a bunch of bad stuff to them, other than, you know, if they would have had social media, they probably would have censored them, you know, but... So now you guys are out there on the forefront of a growing number of people that are suggesting something that is, I think you could kind of put it in the flat earth category, that viruses run around and we can breathe them in and we get sick and we can take them home and give them to our kids. The classic germ theory. Is that the classic germ theory?
I think essentially you've captured it in a nutshell.
It's pretty much the classic germ theory that humans can spread viruses back and forth.
Yeah, well, just basically, you know, microscopic or invisible germs or organisms that, you know, just come in and invade us from everywhere, yeah, right, in the environment and make us sick. And then, of course, they have the caveat that we can then spread those invisible germs from one person to another. That's absolutely the main points of germ theory.
And so the idea then behind the masking and social distancing and all of that is pointing to this theory, right? If you cover up the whatever, cover up this stuff, something like that.
Yeah, I would say, Patrick, every single policy that's been enacted, you know, de novo over the past year plus, is all based on this idea of germ theory and viruses causing illness.
Right. Now, there was a fellow I read about, and I think I heard you mention him one time. I think his name was Enders. And he actually worked for the military and was a pretty high roller guy with a lot of money, too, which is curious. People conjecture that he was trying to sell the military on the idea of a biological warfare to get more funding, which is, I don't know, that's just... Internet's probably true, right? So, but Enders, and has all the virus theory been based on his work from 1950? And if I recall, he was flawed because he didn't make it work in humans. He just did it in a petri dish. Correct, the virus? Is that close?
Well, yeah, Patrick, I mean, you're definitely right that John Enders, you know, who went on to win the Nobel Prize, was of major significance, because the scientists that were looking for some, you know, microscopic invisible agent of disease after the electron microscope was invented in the 1920s, because that allowed scientists to see things much smaller than bacteria, they were basically about to give up on finding a virus, because when they took diseased tissue from someone with an illness they thought was due to a virus, they put it into hosts, they couldn't reproduce the same disease. And they also, when they looked under a microscope, they couldn't purify out a particle that they say was a virus. They couldn't separate them from other particles that are just the normal part of dying tissues and cells. And Enders came and wrote this paper. And what he did that was different is, instead of trying to take a virus and purify it out of someone's body fluid who is ill, he took the body fluid and put it in a foreign cell culture. And this was the first time, I believe, that monkey kidney cells were used in his experiments. And he also put a bunch of other toxins in the cell culture, by the way. And even in that initial experiment, he took, you know, the secretions from children in a measles ward in a hospital, and he mixed them with milk and added that to a cell culture. Huh. Right? Now, milk is certainly not sterile, and it could have particles in it too, right? That could be also called viruses. And what he said in the conclusion of those papers is basically that what he saw in this cell culture doesn't necessarily have anything to do with what's going on in the person with measles. And he went on in another paper to say that there were particles from the kidney cells themselves, and they couldn't be differentiated from anything that came from the, you know, clinical fluid from the measles patient. So in his own papers, he basically said that whatever we're showing in these microscope slides, we don't know if it may be a virus or it may be many other things.
Could be other things, but in the mix.
Yeah, well, tons of other things, because they put so many different things in there that can make particles and have genetic material. You know, who knows what they're looking at? You know, it's kind of like, imagine going into a landfill, you know, and, you know, just photographing it and pointing to something there and, you know, say, look, you know, there's a new animal that we discovered in the landfill.
And then has the whole... Since then, with vaccines and everything, has it been based on this work?
Absolutely. Work? And in fact, that tissue culture experiment is the same exact procedure to manufacture vaccines, you know, up until these genetic experiments that we have currently. Yeah. So after Enders won the Nobel Prize is when the story changed, and his experimental procedure of, you know, observing this toxic cell culture essentially became now the standard way of proving a virus's existence, even though in the paper itself, it didn't make anywhere close to that claim. And this has essentially been repeated by every scientist since that time, since 1954, this invalid procedure, and the results are heralded as proof of a new virus.
Yes, sir.
When, of course, they can't prove any such thing.
I got you. Dr. Thomas Cowan, he's an author, an MD, and he's a farmer, and a very interesting man. We're going to tell you about his books and such. So stick around if you'd like to join the show. We're live here on March 17th, Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. So, Dr. Cowan, when did you first have the idea?
Patrick, can I just add a little bit to what Andy just said?
Yes, you may, sir. You can do whatever you want here. Just do whatever you want.
What Andy was talking about and what you're talking about is actually sort of the key to the kingdom. And I happen to have Enders' paper right here. So this was the 1954 one. And is he...
Oops, sorry.
Put it in 2 milliliters of milk, which is odd because the game we're playing here is find pieces of genetic material, right? Genetic particles. So it seems like the last thing you would want to do is mix it with some other form of genetic material, right? It's like, I want to, you know, I don't know, I can't think of an analogy right now, but I think you know what I mean. Like, that's the game. Look for genetic particles. You don't want to mix the caffeine with tea and et cetera, because then you mess up the experiment. And then he adds penicillin and streptomycin, both antibiotics which are poisonous to tissue cultures, like monkey kidney cells. And then he adds, quote, bovine amniotic fluid, beef embryo extract, bovine serum, antibiotics, and soybean trypsin. Now, so now we have five other sources of particles that have genetic material. And then he says later, interesting, they did a control, although they didn't tell you how they did the control, which is bizarre, because if they do a control and you want to repeat the experiment, they should tell you what they did. But they said, okay, so this, they took snot from measles, mixed it with all these five things and milk, and then it breaks down, right? So that's proof there was a virus, not proof that you just blew up the tissue with your antibiotics and trypsin. And so then they take a non-measles sample, and they said it broke down in exactly the same way. Cytopathic changes it induced in the unstained preparation could not be distinguished with confidence from the viruses isolated from measles. Essentially, Patrick, that's the end of virology right there. If you get the same thing, whether you start with something from measles or whether you start from something not with measles, even though they didn't actually tell you what they were starting with, then it means it wasn't from the measles person, right? That's just logic and common sense. And then they say later, by the way, we can't distinguish whether these particles, like Andy said, are coming from the monkey kidney tissue or from the person with measles. We can't tell the difference. Somebody should check that, he said later. Now, 63 years later, they've checked it, and they say, I have this from Viruses 2020 May, the journal paper, we can't tell the difference whether these are viruses coming from the outside or breaking down of the tissue from the inside. We can't tell if this is just something from the outside or your tissue is just breaking down, and that's why we're seeing particles of all different sorts. And that means we don't have any idea whether they're exogenous viruses at all, because the fact of the matter is, there are no exogenous pathogenic viruses. All of these particles were in a tissue culture are coming from the monkey kidney cells or the milk or the bovine fluid or et cetera. Or they're coming from you because you're breaking down because you're sick.
And how did
it's
I,
just garbage.
How did I get
studying garbage?
Yeah. How did I get sick?
Years.
How did I get sick? You said
something poisoned you and you broke down. And you got sick.
Toxins or EMFs or stinking thinking or something, right?
Let me weigh in on this because, you know, what we're really saying here is that there's been a claim made that viruses cause illness.
Yes.
And so the evidence has to be there to back up that claim, right? Especially now because everyone's lives in the world have been turned upside down as a result of this. Mm-hmm. And we're saying that there's actually no evidence whatsoever of this. And because all of the effort and scientific research for the last 100 years has only been towards studying germ theory-based illnesses primarily, there's no research that we can point to that says this is the true cause. And that's one of the main problems why we have to address this, is because we need to understand what really causes illness. But I do agree with Tom that there are essentially, you know, four major causes of illness. And, you know, poisoning or toxicity is one of the predominant ones, because in our modern culture, we're exposed to thousands of toxic chemicals every day, right? Plus all of the electromagnetic radiation, you know, and other sources of toxicity. So then you have malnutrition or nutrient deficiency. You have trauma, like, you know, a car accident. And then you have psychological trauma. And those are really what cause all illnesses.
And both of you have been arguing for the last year or so, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that if we get to that point and you let go of the germ theory, then we can kind of dig in as a culture, everybody, and start saying, well, what's really making us sick? I mean, come on, let's look at it. What are the causes of disease? And then we could better deal with it. But there are folks out there, including a regular guest of ours who's about 83 years old, wonderful guy, 1968, PhD, Dr. Ray Peet, and I presented the idea of the isolation. He agrees with you all, both, and where you're going with this, and he doesn't believe in the classic germ theory, but he says you can also make, it doesn't have to be absolutely isolated to assume was his words, assume that this caused that, because, you know, he said you can make, it's a judgment call, is his words, it's a judgment call. But you're both arguing that that's not fair. You can't make a judgment in something this important.
Well, you can. First of all, it's fine. You know, here's the irony of this whole quote viral, which is really a tissue culture experiment, which is to this day the only way they ever isolate or prove a virus exists. Right. So it's the same. If you take snot and mix it with bovine serum, et cetera, and antibiotics, even then it doesn't break down. They have to starve and poison the tissue, and then it breaks down. And the irony is that's exactly how we get sick. You starve and poison us, and then we get sick.
Oh, just so like the tissue. Yeah, let me back up. That's interesting.
Let me say this.
Go ahead.
Ray Peet, if I was to say to you, Patrick, you're right. We don't have to isolate anything to prove it causes anything.
Uh-huh.
Here, I'm going to show you that this ping pong ball can knock down this wall. So I put the ping pong ball in a bucket of rocks and ice. I throw it in a wall. It knocks it down. There, I've proven the ping pong ball knocks down the wall. What do you say to that? Is it a judgment call?
It was a judgment call.
Lunacy.
It was a judgment call.
It's not a judgment.
No, you know, I know what that's you're saying.
Nonsense.
No, that's a great analogy.
No human being thinks like that.
Yeah.
Except people who somehow are convinced that they shouldn't think about this anymore. Human beings say, okay, if I want to know whether that ping pong ball knocked down the wall, I don't put it in a bucket of stones. I don't show you a computer animation. I don't try to convince you because I found a ping pong ball with little spiky things coming off the side. I don't show you 20 experts who say, yes, I think ping pong balls knock down walls. No human being thinks like that. They say, look, Patrick, take the ping pong ball, throw it at the wall, just the ping pong ball, and if that knocks down the wall, we're good. End of story. There's no judgment in that.
Okay, I can't tell you how many emails I've received when I talk about this, and people say, now, wait a minute, though. My husband came home. He had the flu. I got the flu. My kids got the flu. I mean, that proves that this, we each caught a virus. I mean, I get that email all the time.
Yeah, Patrick, right. This is, you know, it's a flaw in reasoning. But let me also say it highlights a bigger point, because even if you are, you know, very analytical and you want to look at all of the statistics and all of the studies on masks and on mortality and you know, isolation and all these things, you know, it's hard to come up with a conclusive opinion because all of this data is a lot of conjecture. Like, we have things like computer simulations, epidemiologic, like, you know, as Tom's pointed out before, if you know people are sick, that doesn't tell you anything about what causes it. It tells you that you should look for what might cause it, right? And we can't use that information. But and because we assume that there's a virus, right, an assumption, right, rather than actual rigorous conclusion, that we then are confused about all this other evidence. Like, what is making us sick? We don't know, right? Do masks work? We don't know. Are more people really dead? Well, the numbers won't be in for another year, right? But once we understand there is no virus, all of those things then make sense, because whatever it is, we know there's another explanation. You know, if you're sick and there's no evidence of a virus, well, you know something else caused it. And I'd want to know the answer to that question, of course, you know, myself, just like you. But when you ask the question, you know, is there a virus? It's not a judgment call, because either there is or there isn't, right? You prove that something exists or you can't prove it, in which case it doesn't exist. And that's why this issue actually is the only issue that you really need to examine. And it's not difficult to understand, because what Tom just described with the ping pong ball situation is that's exactly what's happening in the laboratory.
So that's why you keep going back to the basic idea, right? That's why you keep going back to the basic idea, the title of the show, Show Me the Virus.
Exactly.
Go ahead, Tom.
And the other thing, Patrick, is, as Andy said, first of all, and as Andy has said a number of times, we have to remember that a virus is a thing, right? We're not talking about a feeling spreading, which would be hard to document, or a thought spreading, right? We're talking about a thing, and we know that there are experimental methods going back almost 100 years where we can isolate and photograph this thing, things exactly that size, like bacteriophages and giant viruses. So it's not a hard thing to isolate. This has been done, and we have pictures of them all over the literature. The other thing I would say to these people is, so you don't mean that just because something happens to a bunch of people, that means it's a virus. Because if you think that, you must think Hiroshima was a virus. And if you think that because something spreads, that must mean it's a virus, you must think that Chernobyl was a virus because it spread all over Eastern Europe. And if you think that the only thing that spreads between people is a virus, how do you explain you put 20-year-old women in a cabin for 6 months and they all menstruate at the same time? Is that a virus? As far as I know, nobody thinks that. And what about just the feeling of goodwill when you walk in a room? You know, somebody with a big smile and has something pleasant to say, and next thing you know, everybody's laughing. I mean, and so there's some physiological response that happens between people. I don't know anybody who thinks that's a virus. Well, probably some people do, but
I understand.
You know, nobody sane does.
Are you both familiar with Dr. Zach? Go ahead.
Spreading things equal virus is, frankly, crazy.
Great. Are you all familiar with Dr. Zach Bush's work?
A little bit.
So this idea that I saw a documentary that he produced, and on the face of it, it seemed like, interesting stuff, and like he knew what he was talking about, but he's claiming that these viruses, there's billions of them, there's everywhere, and they're circulating the globe. They do not live, and they don't need people to circulate, right? They just are. It's just
Patrick, it'd be really easy to answer that question, okay, because if these things are everywhere, well, show them to me. Go out and collect, and then you'll have them. You can purify them and then demonstrate it. And then we'll have no problem believing it.
I understand. But how is it that we can share, and you both can really talk about what you, and explain to people that this word is new to them, exosomes, who are actually sharing maybe genetic updates and all of that, if you're into that idea. How can we share those and not share a virus that's trying to kill us?
Well, Patrick, exosomes are something that can actually be demonstrated. So now you can definitely discuss about the validity of the microscopic techniques, but what they can do is they can take a person with a certain condition, of illness where they're making exosomes, which are these particles the same size and shape as they say viruses are, and they can do the purification procedure like Tom mentioned that they've done with bacteriophages, and they can actually then pull out the genetic material and look at it. And you can find lots of papers where they've done this, right? But why can't they do the same thing with viruses? If they did that and demonstrated them, we'd have no problem agreeing that they're a real thing. But as far as spreading these particles from person to person, I'm not aware of any studies that have showed that. They've only showed them in a person, and they've showed them in some bodily secretions of a person. But we don't know if they pass anything between people. I'm not aware of any research studies. But that could certainly be a possible mechanism, because we know that there are ways people pass information between each other, right? This idea of contagion, there is some validity that people pass things along, right? Like the example with synchronizing menstrual cycles. There's many other examples. I mean, sometimes it's a very simple mechanism. Like, for example, this time of the year, we're getting to the end of winter, and I might look out in the afternoon and see one of my neighbors cleaning up their yard. And then, you know, I'll get the idea, and then a few days later, I'll be cleaning up my yard, and then you'll see other neighbors doing that. Right. So this, and in that time, I didn't talk to the neighbor. The neighbor didn't come over and tell me, hey, you might clean up your yard. It's looking pretty sloppy. Right. Yeah. It was just, you know, like it was a nonverbal communication. And that happens in even more subtle ways, like laughter, like even in classrooms of young children, that it's often witnessed that if one child vomits in the class, that within minutes you have now a whole bunch of kids also throwing up, right? So this somehow information passes from person to person, but we don't understand how that happens at all. When they've done studies trying to show an agent of transmission like a virus, there's no evidence of it. They only use these fake surrogate tests like a PCR to show there's genetic material, but there's genetic material everywhere. It's just like if you test for fecal material, and this may be disturbing to some of the viewers, but this happens in like restaurants and stuff. You find fecal particles everywhere, but that doesn't mean that they're getting into people and making them sick. So, you know, you really have to carefully do experiments to show any of this, and you can't, you know, you can have ideas, but then you have to test them.
Dr. Thomas Cowan is with us, Dr. Andrew Kaufman, Patrick Timpone. We're live here March 17th. Dr. Cowan, would you explain and kind of talk to us like we're a young child or a golden retriever? We like that one around here. To people that will watch this, I'm going to send it to my sisters and brothers and family who are germ theory guys and wanting to get the vaccine. How it's possible that people can actually, they believe, get the flu in the same household, so they believe that, you know, we're spreading stuff back and forth. Can you explain how is that that's possible, why that is, why it happens, which it happens all the time, right?
So you have to go back to what Andy just said. So first of all, if what you're talking about is what's called an epidemiological observation, right? In other words, the role of epidemiology in science is I investigate and I see 20 people get sick in one place. And so I think it could be the sewage, it could be a microbe, it could be radiation, it could be somebody hexed them, etc. The purpose of that is to generate hypotheses that can then be tested. Now, in the situation you're talking about, that is exactly what that happens there. So I see 3 people or 10 people in a place, and they all seem to get sick with the same thing. So I have a hypothesis that it must be a virus, mm-hmm. right? So then you look. Turns out it's not true. If anybody can show me any single evidence that all 10 of those people, you can isolate a pathogenic virus, purify it, and make anybody else sick, because every single time that experiment has been done, it has been shown that that doesn't work like that, period. If you don't believe me, show me the study. It doesn't exist. Therefore, you have to conclude that even though that may have been a reasonable hypothesis, it's simply not true. Now, you get into what might have been the problem there.
Yeah.
I would first of all point out that just because you don't know what the problem is doesn't mean that the incorrect answer is somehow correct. You know, we've had examples. One of the ones I've been talking about is there was an example of a supposed plane crash, and then there was a big hole, and the people looked at it, and there was no plane. And then they said there was a plane. And all I know is that if a plane crashes, there's plane debris and dead bodies. There was none of that there. That couldn't have been a plane crash. How did that hole get there? I don't know. Maybe somebody came with a backhoe the night before and dug it up. Or maybe somebody shot a rocket ship. Or I don't know. How? I mean, just because I don't know. Now, I have some ideas as to what happened there. First of all, what we're talking about is, quote, sickness like a flu is fundamentally a misnomer. You get a splinter in your finger, you make pus to get it out. This thing that we call pus and coughing and mucus is the body's way of getting rid of toxins, period. In other words, something poisons you or something splinters you or you breathe in dust or glyphosate and you eat bad food and you have something to get rid of, your body decides, okay, I'm going to make a cough and mucus and get rid of this stuff. Unfortunately, the people, and most particularly the doctors, have been convinced that that's the disease. It's the therapy. And so then, you know, we suppress the therapy and make people even sicker. And sometimes it seems like somebody in a house does it, maybe because there's an electromagnetic field in the house, maybe there's new wallpaper, maybe they're all scared of going bankrupt because they all lost their jobs, maybe they're all wearing masks, maybe somebody sprayed roach killer in the house. I mean, I don't know. I'd have to investigate the situation. Why do we think that every single situation has to be the same? That's unrealistic. I can tell you, 35 years of doing medicine like this, almost every time, if you just investigate, you could find out, you know, hey, you shouldn't have spread roach killer in your house because now everybody's sick. And they're sick, meaning they have this poison in them and they have to cough it up. And we call that being sick, which is a horrible disservice and misnomer. Now, I can also imagine it could be a psychological thing. It could be an emotional thing. It could be even a, you know, constellation. I mean, the fact, like Andy said, we spent no effort, no money, no time looking into why people get sick. So they say, well, Tom, you don't have a study. Of course I don't have a study. Nobody did the study.
Nobody did the study. Here's an email from Rose. For either of you, just jump in. I've been reading about Anton Beauchamp. Is it B-E-C-H-A-M-P? Is it called, pronounced Beauchamp?
It's Beauchamp. It's Beauchamp. A hard one to say.
And his description of what he called microzymes, granular bodies within the body structure of all living things, which he saw as the smallest entity of life. My question, are those granular bodies recognized today as part of the living organisms? And if so, what are they called? How do you see them and their role in human health and disease? Or is there some other understanding of them today? Bob Beauchamp.
Yeah. Should I take that one, Tom?
Whatever.
Yeah. Go ahead. It's a great question, by the way.
Yes, it is. So what you're really talking about is related to the topic that is referred to as pleomorphism. And Beauchamp was, you know, the first one to observe these bodies that I'm aware of, but several other researchers did additional work and have all replicated this, including Reich, including Enderlein, and a couple of others. And I think it's important to, you know, take one step back before you take on this subject and realize that almost all mainstream medical research and biology over the last century has been looking at dead tissues and cells. So in other words, they kill the organism or the cell culture first and then process the tissue in many ways and stain it with different things, including heavy metals, and then look at it under the microscope, which is very, very different from looking at something that's alive. Because one thing we know is that things change after life is no longer in the organism. Like, you know, we've observed this with our own bodies, that they go into rigor mortis, right? Now, this is a change from how they are when you are alive. So we don't know if what we're looking at under the microscope is part of the change after death, and it's not represent what's alive. So it's really important to always correlate these things, but also realizing that when you can look at living tissue and cells under the microscope and observe it directly, you can observe the behavior of what's going on. And not just, you know, something that may be an artifact of the staining process or of the death of the tissue. And that's what Bechamp was looking at under what's called a dark field microscope, which is a type of light microscope that you can look at living blood, for example. Mm-hmm. And there are scientists and practitioners that still use this today, for example, like the Bigelson brothers. Mm-hmm. And what you see if you look at, let's say, living blood cells in a dark field microscope is that there are these little specks of light, and they're very distinct. And if you spend a lot of time observing, you can see that these specks change form. They go in and out of cells, and then they change form and shape. And essentially, what the theory says is that they become microorganisms like bacteria and fungi, and perhaps they are actually can become any type of cell or organism, but I don't think we've observed that directly. And so what happens is that your body can liberate these microzyma, or they're also called proteids or somatids or bionts, and they can then develop into the appropriate organism to assist the healing process. Because in nature, the role of microorganisms, we call them saprophytes. And we've all observed this out in the woods, where the microorganisms break down dead material, and that be plant material or animal material, and reduce it back into the constituent elements that can go back into the earth and then spring forth new life. And this is the renewal cycle of nature. Well, when we have an illness in our body, it causes damage and death of parts of our tissues. And so our body sends these microorganisms to that area to do the cleanup and the healing work, just like they do in other areas of nature. And like Tom said, this may be the active or symptomatic phase of the illness when we have secretions, because that is the way to purge the materials that are waste products and toxins. And, you know, a great thing about looking at this formulation or this paradigm of, you know, terrain theory and pleomorphism is that it's really easy to observe our body's own reactions to things and know that it makes sense. Like when we are producing secretions, right? When we have a runny nose and coughing, well, it's pretty obvious our body's trying to get rid of something, right? Something that it doesn't want, or something that's causing damage, right? And, you know, we might, based on our upbringing, think that these things are germs, but that's not really what's in there, because they'd be able to find viruses in there if they were in there. But just knowing that your body is doing this naturally, right? It's getting rid of what doesn't belong. And if you understand that and trust in it, you can actually support your body doing its natural healing. Like, for example, by having enough clean water so that your body can make those secretions and without, you know, thinning your, without making your blood too thick. That can really help, you know, your body do its job of getting rid of those waste products so that it can rebuild healthy tissue underneath.
So we could say then that when we have these flu symptoms, whatever they are, once a year or every few years, if some people do, that it's a blessing. It's a it's a good thing. Whatever's going on, this is the way it works. It's kind of like you have a fever. I can remember when I was a kid in the 50s, and you know, I got a sick or whatever was going on, my mom would pile blankets over me, right, all night long. And boy, I woke up and the whole bed was wet, right? But I was feeling great. Okay, go to school. That was it. It's time for school. And so did the heat just kind of burn up, you know, the heat fever and with my mom's blankets just burn up? But what was it burning up if there was no virus in there?
But Patrick, this has been the hallmark of every single medical culture until modern medicine. They all did sweat lodges, and they all did saunas, and they all had this blessed by illness concept. They knew that you had something that needed to be eliminated, and so if you work with the body's processes, like make the cough come out easier, or increase the sweating, or give you diarrhea for a while,
right?
There's a very interesting word we use. Then you're better, because you're actually better than when you started. And if you do it the other way, which is you give Tylenol and antibiotics or prevent it with so-called vaccines, then you're worse for life. And by the way, some of the most famous cancer therapies, like Coley's toxins, have simply been, okay, the person's sick, let's give them, they have cancer, let's give them a high fever for a month, and at the end of that, the cancer is gone. So this has been used therapeutically by every single medical culture in human history until the radical theory of modern medicine. The modern medicine is a radical departure from human history.
Michelle writes, I'm just confused about the whole measles thing and the vaccine. I don't want to do a vaccine. I'm paraphrasing because she did a very long and she wants you to explain what's going on when kids get the measles.
The same as we just said. There's measles is a maturation process. And we know that children who have measles have less chronic disease. They have less asthma, they have less eczema, they have less neurological disease. It's part of the maturation process that all children go through because of some sort of, you know, it's what I would say universal experience. It's like a snake shedding its skin. And so the snake sheds its skin and then it goes on with life. You know, children have something. You know, they don't eat quite enough collagen, or there's a little stuff they need to eliminate because we're all full of toxins around now. And so they do it 7 days. They're all better. They have less brain cancer, less cancer in general, less heart disease, less arthritis for the rest of their life. To stop that process is madness.
Well, Dr. Cohn, you're no fun because... You know, we wouldn't need doctors except if we made an emergency situation, broke a bone, or got in a car wreck, or something, right? I mean, we really...
Right. You go to a doctor when you got something impaled in your leg, and your good friend can't get it out.
They're good at it. They're good at it. God love them, right? They're good at it.
There's a few other times, maybe, but
yeah, I understand.
Just basically.
Yeah, I understand.
Patrick, I just want to, if I may, just kind of reiterate, to drive home some of these points, because, you know, if you have lesions on your skin, right, that have fluid like chicken pox, for example, that's also your body getting rid of something. So essentially any illness where something comes out of your body, that means your body's trying to purge something that doesn't belong, that's making you sick, right? And that's with the fever, it makes you sweat. So you get rid of things that way. And also, the higher temperature makes more things dissolve, right? So it may, things that don't dissolve very well may get removed because of the fever. And then even parasites may also be damaged by the fever or encouraged to leave. So there's, you know, basically it's all of these illnesses. If there's something coming out of your body, then that tells you your body's getting rid of whatever's causing the problem.
So that would be even...
If there isn't something coming out, yeah, you should do something to make it come out.
Do something. Push it.
Yeah. Or maybe your nutrient deficiency in that situation too, and that's something to consider.
I remember I guess in my 20s when I got pimples, they gave me tetracycline, right? That was going to get rid of my pimples. Remember that one, Dr. Collin? Did you?
I still do that, Patrick.
Okay, so Dr. Thomas Cowan and Andrew Kaufman are with us. We're not going to get to all the emails, but we'll keep them as long as they'll let us. So what's the difference between bacteria and virus with this whole germ theory? Is it similar?
Well, I mean, it is similar in some ways, but they can actually show bacteria. So you can easily purify bacteria out of people, both when they're ill and healthy. So it's sort of a different problem. But once again, if we really look at how it's shown that illnesses that bacteria would cause a disease, they're unable to demonstrate that. So for example, like a simple thing like strep throat.
Yes.
Now, streptococcus, which is, they say, causes this illness, it's a normal bacteria that's present in our body. And if you did throat cultures on 100 people without a strep throat and 100 people with strep throat, you'd find lots of positives in both groups because streptococcus is normal to live in your throat. Mm-hmm. So how can you say, you know, it causes the disease? There was a famous microbiology professor in the early 20th century, and he used to actually swallow a pure culture of cholera bacteria in front of his class because, you know, that's another one. Cholera produces a diarrheal illness that can actually cause a lot of fatalities in poor countries because they just can't stay hydrated and they die of dehydration. And, it you know, we're told that this is caused by this bacteria, Vibrio cholera. But this professor, you know, correctly pointed out that it had nothing to do with it, but it wasn't the bacteria that caused the illness. And he would swallow a pure culture of that bacteria in front of his class and then show that he didn't get sick afterwards. And what really is the case with cholera is that when that bacteria and other bacteria that it lives with, because bacteria don't live in a single species in nature, they live in communities of dozens or hundreds of different bacteria together. And they can't really live in a pure way. That's only done in the laboratory. But in this community of bacteria, when there's sewage in the water, they eat the sewage and their waste products, like their pee and poop, is toxic. And it's that pee and poop, the excretion of the bacteria, that causes the cholera, not the bacteria invading the person. So in other words, it's a poison. And this is just like food poisoning works, that, you know, you have some macaroni salad for your summer picnic and you left it out too long. And not that the bacteria grow on it, but it's the bacteria waste product, the Staph toxin, that makes you sick and throw up and get diarrhea when you eat it. It's not that the bacteria multiply in your body and cause illness. That doesn't happen at all.
If I traveled and took in some bacteria from a foreign country of some kind, Mexico, wherever, don't want to pick on them, and my girlfriend and I then did a lot of swap some spit at night, you know, because we were on vacation, and could we share that bacteria with each other?
Of course, we share all our bacteria all the time. And of course, you know, more so with people you're intimate with. But yeah, but that's not going to make you sick.
Oh, it wouldn't make her sick. If I was trying to get rid of this bacteria with diarrhea, whatever, it wouldn't transfer to her.
Saying, Patrick, is you wouldn't be getting rid of any bacteria with diarrhea.
Oh.
The reason you get diarrhea and food poisoning is because when the bacteria eats dying flesh, right, which is decomposing, when you eat dying flesh, your waste products can be toxic. Just like the same thing with you, Patrick, if you ate rotten meat and had diarrhea, your diarrhea would be toxic because it's your body getting rid of the toxic waste material. And so the same thing, when bacteria eat rotting flesh, they make toxic waste. And when you eat that toxic waste, it makes you sick. And your body creates the diarrhea to flush it out. right? And if you gave that diarrhea to someone else to drink, they would be drinking the same poison. But there's the bacteria only grows on the rotting meat. It doesn't grow in your body because your body's alive.
Right. It's basically the idea is there are lots of different toxins. Like if you get bit by a snake, you can die. If you get bit by a bat, you could die.
Uh-huh.
All these things have toxins in them. So do certain kinds of bacteria. So you can extend the possible toxin producing organisms to bacteria. And it's not good to eat or to be exposed or injected with various toxins. That's a far different cry than the fact that there's some, quote, infection that's transmissible and causing sickness.
Right. Like the snake that bites you and makes you sick, it doesn't go inside your body and have babies, right? It just, it's poison in your body. And that's the same thing with certain bacteria that make these poisons.
What about a thing that's pretty popular, the rabies virus in canines? What's up with that? Is there, do you all have
any? Same thing. Show us an isolated, purified rabies.
Yeah.
Show us that you isolate and purify the rabies virus and make somebody sick with it, and we will stop talking.
Do you know?
It doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen. Wow.
There's no evidence of that in the medical literature.
Would that be the same thing? I know you all aren't, both aren't veterinarians, but parvo and all this other stuff, they vaccinate the puppies with all that stuff. Same thing? Same idea?
All that stuff.
Wow. You know, that's a big...
Absolutely.
Same rock and roll. They've got a winning playbook here.
That's right.
They're going to stick to it.
Oh, let me see that new kitten. Look at that. Oh, my God.
Right. We're not saying, you know, that there's not animals who exhibit the illness of rabies.
Sure.
Right. People have observed that directly. We're just saying that there's no proof that there's a virus causing it.
Right.
We're
that
not
again?
Saying people don't get sick with the flu. We're not saying people don't have strep throat.
Right.
We're not saying people don't get hypoxic or have blood disorders from getting bitten by a snake. That's not the issue. The issue is if you want to say that such of a thing is a cause, you have to isolate the ping pong ball and show that's the problem. And once you do that, you know, then we're done. And except the problem is they either don't try or they tried and can't find it or they just don't even bother anymore.
So is it true
that Tom and I would like to retire from this? You know, we would, if they did this successfully, we would retire tomorrow.
Dr. Cowan wants to be a farmer and do his, you know. So is it true that you and others are really trying to prove yourself wrong with this? You would like to, you know, like you say, get to the truth and then move on?
I'm
saying.
Sort of helping peripherally a guy named Stefan Lanka do these studies in a proper controlled way. You know, take somebody with COVID. We're not necessarily saying there is or there isn't a COVID illness, but somebody who everybody thinks there is, you know, this person supposedly has this illness. Let's find the virus. Fair enough. You know, there's a way to do it, same as you do it with a bacteriophage. We'll find it and then isolate it and then spray it in some animal's nose. Not like the way they do nasal insufflation. They anesthetize the animal, hang it upside down, forcibly stick some stuff in their lungs, and they call that nasal insufflation. I mean, this is nuts. And if they do that and show an illness called, you know, the same symptoms, then we both get to retire.
Hmm. George,
we got that one wrong.
George wants. Go ahead.
But you have to. If you're going to say something like that, you have to do the science, and then we're going to do. You know, Andy can talk about how they do the genome, which is
Before we do that, let's say this is a great question from George. He is in Seattle where he's not sleepless. George says, well, what about bacterial pneumonia? I had a grandmother that would have died of pneumonia if she wouldn't have been given an antibiotic.
Well, I've seen plenty of patients in the ICU with pneumonia, and not one of them ever got better with an antibiotic.
Really?
Bacterial pneumonia in, you know, people who have chronic illness, it's essentially the final, you know, pathway into death. It really is. Basically, you know, no matter what illness that you have, when you get to that stage where your body can no longer is viable, pneumonia and sepsis set in always, because the bacteria are there to really eat dead and dying flesh. And when your flesh is dead and dying, they start eating it. And that's the normal saprophytic process of nature. And so when we're seeing this, you know, so-called bacterial pneumonia in these people at the end of their life, we're just seeing the onset of their death. It's not an illness per se in and of itself. But if we're talking about other people who are healthy and recover from that, and, you know, I think that I've been diagnosed with bacterial pneumonia at one point in my past. Once again, there's no evidence that those things are caused by the bacteria. Even tuberculosis, you can find, first of all, you don't find the tuberculosis bacteria present in everyone with TB, and then you can find it present in plenty of people without TB. So how can you say it causes this illness? Well, it only causes it in some people some of the time. That's, that's not science.
Casey wants to know, has anyone...
The other thing, Patrick.
Yes.
Let me just...
Go ahead.
You can sometimes see, you know, a person has a sore throat and they have strep, and then you give them an antibiotic and their symptoms go away.
Yes, yeah.
Or at least for a while. So what's happening then is you've stopped the resolution of the illness. So now they're left with, you know, dead and dying tissue in their throat, which can't be recycled. So the prediction is they'll just do it again, which is exactly what you see, and again, and then they get worse, and then you can actually demonstrate that they have a higher incidence of chronic illness, because now they're walking around life with dead and dying tissue in their throat, and all you did was stop that inevitable resolution phase, and that's not really medicine, that's suppressing symptoms to make everything worse. And, you know, here's another example. Somebody sent me, there was a famous leprosy colony, I think it was in Louisiana. It was something like 60 or 70 years. And leprosy is considered, it's a similar organism as TB, mm-hmm. and it's considered highly contagious. The interesting thing is, after 70 years or so, there was not one case of a nurse or worker in the leprosy, sanatorium or whatever they call it, who actually got sick. It was only the people who came there with leprosy. So even one of the most highly contagious organisms, supposedly, apparently, like Florence Nightingale said, if you go in with a pure heart and fresh air, you don't get sick.
You don't get it. It just, something popped up I think you might find interesting. We've done a lot of work with natural dentistry over these last 15 years, and my dentist, Dr. Stuart Nunley, did a peer-reviewed studies on root canals, you know, where they did all these, and looked at them, you know, when they pulled them out, and they had to get them all checked out and approved by their peers. And in everyone that were studied, they found things like leprosy, hep C, herpes, all kinds of stuff in these root canals, in the body. So, you know, I asked him, but I'll ask you both, where did these come from? What are they doing in my root canal?
Well, I think probably you'd have to look at what test they're using to detect these things. And I imagine that they didn't actually culture any bacteria. Ah. They didn't show any viruses under the microscope. What you have here are antibody or PCR tests. So they're showing a fragment of genetic material that, of course, you can look up a scientific paper and it says it's part of a virus. But as we've discussed, there are no viruses that have been proven to exist. So they've never taken genetic material from a virus. That's what it is.
So even with this, it wasn't isolated, you're arguing.
I haven't seen this actual study, but I'm making some assumptions here. But and if you send it to me, I can verify.
Okay, cool.
But all the other studies I've seen that study things in this manner, they use those surrogate tests, right? And you know, like, let me give you an example of how this can be so misleading. In the 70s, there was one summer where there was a major heat wave in New York City, and sometime in the summer, there was a big article in one of the newspapers there that said, you know, ice cream causes violence. And what happened is that you had, because of the heat, you had two things occur. You had increased ice cream sales because people wanted to cool off. And you had increased violence because when people are hot and can't get relief, they get irritable and fight with each other. Mm-hmm. But this, because you weren't looking at the violence directly, right? It was assumed to be related or caused by the ice cream. Obviously, this is, you know, an obvious error, right? But you can make the same associations in these situations you're talking about and be, you know, totally wrong. So you have to first show that the test actually means the presence of this thing and this thing only, not that it's just ice cream on a hot day.
Casey in Miami wants to know, have they done an autopsy on anyone during this corona event and found this coronavirus in their tissues?
Well, they've never...
No. No. But Dr. Cowan, how would you know if they did, though? You wouldn't really know if they did, would you? Because nobody's going to publish that and say, look, oh, would they publish it? Look, we found this.
They absolutely would publish that.
Would they?
So there's a paper that makes a claim on this, actually, where they had the lung tissue of someone they say died of this. But once again, they showed the same exact thing as the tissue cultures. They showed dying cells with a bunch of particles, but they did not purify any particles or demonstrate what they are. And we know that all dying tissues and cells put off particles. That is the dying process. So it was, you know, meaningless. But I think the more important point about autopsies is that they've just hardly done any autopsies. Normally, if you have a health emergency or a crisis, in fact, this was written into law in the United States in many jurisdictions, they would autopsy every single body who died of this suspected emergency. And they did the opposite in this case because they knew if they did autopsy all these bodies, they would find that they died of the same normal causes of death that are already known, and they wouldn't find any evidence of a new illness.
Here's Howard. He has a couple of questions. CCP is supposed...
Patrick, can I say something about that?
Yes, sir. Go for it.
So we've all seen this electron microscope picture of the coronavirus, right? With the dots.
Yes, sir.
You know, a circle with the dots.
The crowns. The crowns.
So here's an interesting paper I was reviewing. It's apparently the first isolation, quote, we know what that means, from a of a coronavirus from a person outside of China in Australia. Mm-hmm. I could read it. Isolation and rapid sharing of the 2019 novel coronavirus from the first patient diagnosed with COVID-19 in Australia. It was somewhere around March 2020. So they did the same thing we just talked about. They did a tissue culture. They took some snot of one person, grew it on Vero cells, and then they got these characteristic coronavirus, which clinched the deal. Now, here's what they said. I'm going to read it and then explain it. And I'm quoting from the article. Electron micrographs of section Vero cells showed cytoplasmic membrane-bound vesicles containing coronavirus particles. Following several attempts to recover virions with the characteristic fringe of surface spike proteins, it was found that adding trypsin to the cell culture medium immediately improved virion morphology. Now, that's a big mouthful, and probably a lot of people don't know what he said, but here's what he said. We did a culture. We found these little particles, but they didn't look like the coronavirus particles. So we added trypsin in there, which is a pancreatic enzyme, which digests proteins, and then we saw the little spikes. Now, that's like I go to a pile of wood, and I think there must be star-shaped pile of pieces of wood in there, right? That's what I'm looking for. So I look through the wood. There's no star shape. There's only squares. So I call my carpenter friend, and he cuts out some pieces from the wood. Oh, my God, there's the stars.
I love your analogy.
And so, in fact, they didn't find anything that looked like a coronavirus until they added a pancreatic enzyme, protease enzyme, which digests the outside so it looked like a coronavirus. That should have been, I mean,
that's amazing.
This is crazy.
You know, I got a couple questions on the whole biological lab Wuhan thing, which has been going around forever.
But the point is, when you say they found it, you have to know what they
what
did.
What they really did to find it, right? Yes. What the process.
Otherwise, you don't have a clue whether they added, you know, it was a PCR test or an antibody, which means nothing. You know, you don't have a clue what happened.
Do you think it's possible?
I mean, imagine if they found, if they were looking for a chicken and they found a pig and they say it didn't look like a chicken, so they glued a bunch of chicken feathers onto the pig and then said, there's a chicken.
There it is.
There's a chicken.
I knew we had a chicken.
Everybody can see it. It's a chicken.
That's a chicken. I know it's a chicken. Do you think it's possible that some crazy people could create some kind of a biological virus in a lab and, you know, spray it in airplanes or do something, and we could share it with
each? That's what you call a vaccine.
Oh, that's a vaccine. But
yeah, you can make an individual sick by injecting that toxin into somebody. But here's the good news, Patrick. You can't make a spreadable virus because, you know, God made it so it doesn't work like that. So
is
they
that
can
right?
try all they want.
No, wait a minute. Explain that to me. So you couldn't get really creative in a spooky way and create a virus, get it out there, and it just doesn't work like that. We don't spread it by breathing or touching or...
No.
We just don't.
You can inject it in somebody and make them sick. That's like what Andy said.
That's
actually
a vaccine.
They do that all the time. That's called a vaccine. And that confuses people because they say, oh, I took this vaccine and then I got sick. So somehow that must mean, and so did my next door neighbor and the next door neighbor. Therefore, you have a spreadable virus. I mean, oh, man.
And I got goosebumps. I got goosebumps when you told me about the idea that even if they did it in a lab and you got spooky, you just couldn't spread it anyway. So the whole, you just couldn't do it. You just can't do it. Wow.
You know, Patrick, if you want to get wild and science fictiony, although this may be closer than you think, well, maybe you could have like robot mosquitoes that could fly around and inject poison to people.
That's a good screenplay.
You know? And it might appear like it goes from person to person if they did that, because we might not even notice the mosquitoes.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Right. Yeah, that could do it. So what about things?
And there is. You know, I don't know if Andy and I agree on this. I could imagine if you could aerosolize this thing in some sort of absorbable medium
and
spray it right into people and
maybe,
like, you know, have them like go to a station and open their mouth and stuff it. You know, then you could maybe
then you
do
could get it. Yeah.
But,
you know, from an engineering point of view, it's actually challenging. Because, you know, if it's a particle, like if it goes in through your mouth, then it's going to be neutralized by your stomach acid. If you try to put it in the air, there's so much area to cover that it gets diluted massively, right? So it's like the vaccine injection is really the most reliable way, because you know 100% of what's in that syringe gets into the person's body and only the person who takes the injection. So in other words, no one will accidentally get sick who's not supposed to by that means. And you can guarantee that the effect of what's in that syringe will take hold of the person because it's bypassing all of the barriers that we have to keep our bodies safe.
So the viruses right. aren't things, as you have argued. They're just not things.
No, they are. They're supposedly things.
They're supposedly things. But if we have a thing like a glyphosate or mercury or some weird thing, it's a thing. And if it comes in by food, air, water, or injection, then we can get it out because it is a thing by detoxification.
Maybe. If you're lucky.
If we're good at it. Yeah, if we're good at it, yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
I mean, they might figure out a way so you can't get it out,
sure.
or it's hard to get out.
Sure.
Right?
Sure. Yeah.
I was going to say that our bodies have lots of mechanisms to get rid of toxic materials, but it's really mostly toxic materials that exist in the natural environment, right? Like right. our own waste products, for example. But probably also bacterial toxins, right? That's why we have the diarrhea reaction. Mm-hmm. But some things that didn't exist in the natural world that would get into our bodies, like many of the heavy metals that you mentioned, those only, came into our bodies as a result of the Industrial Revolution and yes. mining operations, and then they're put in healthcare products. Yeah. So our bodies may not have as easy a time getting rid of some of these things because we just don't have like a natural built-in mechanism to get rid of metals, for
right
example.
To do it. One emailer says...
Like an example of that is aluminum, which,
right?
aluminum is all over the place, but the absorption of aluminum orally is 0.001%. We don't absorb it orally. And we don't have, as far as I know, any detoxification or excretion mechanisms for this. And as far as I know, there's no, enzyme reaction or biological use for aluminum. So I tell people, if there's a substance that basically poisons your nerves and we don't absorb it and we don't know how to excrete it and we don't know how to use it, don't inject it into your body because you may not be able to get it out.
Like perspiration even? Aluminum could get in there, perspirants, maybe?
Well, no, you injected it.
I'm sorry.
Right.
It's in all vaccines.
It's in all vaccines.
Aluminum hydroxide.
Right. Right.
Yes. And there are other sources of it, like in our food and cookware and in antiperspirants, absolutely. And some of that will get absorbed. But 100% of it from a vaccine injection gets in your body, and your body does not have a way to process it. So what it does is it sequesters it. It forms what are called granulomata, which is basically just a sealed room. And it keeps it there as long as possible because it doesn't have anything else it can do. It can't easily get rid of it. It can't process it and turn it into something safe. So that's why there's so much toxicity from some of these substances and some of these medical products, because they're simply toxins our body's not prepared to deal with. And it's very, very difficult, even with the best techniques that we know out there. It's very, very difficult and not guaranteed that you'll be able to get rid of these things.
And there could be a connection, could be, with aluminum and dementia and other brain kind of things.
Well, there's actually considerable evidence yes. of higher levels of aluminum in the brains of people with various neurologic diseases, including dementia like Alzheimer's, yeah. and also autism.
Yeah.
And this is the exact kind of research that we need a lot more of so that we can understand this, so that we can develop. So one is that we can understand that it's very dangerous to add aluminum to our bodies. And so we can eliminate it, the exposure. And then we can also look at, maybe there are ways to successfully eliminate it. And if we do research on that, we can, compare those things and come up with the best approach.
We had Dr. Exley on, aluminum guy, Christopher Exley, about a month ago, and he suggested that sweating will get rid of aluminum too. He said that. I don't know if that's true. Before we go, let's...
Well, it will, we would, to some degree.
Okay, just we would be remiss if we didn't talk about these injectable things. Did you all have a chance to see the video I sent? You probably saw it. It really went viral with this Gert fellow, who is a vaccine manufacturer, not a manufacturer, but a designer. He's not an anti-vaxxer. He's a vaccine guy. And he was explaining how dangerous these things are. Dr. Cowan, I wanted to ask you, did you see that video?
I saw 5 minutes, and then I said, I can't deal with this.
You can't deal with it. So I was going to ask you, was it similar to your book and the innate immune system, what this fellow was talking about, or you just disagreed with his talk about that?
I mean, the way I see that is he was, the only thing the powers that be are afraid of is what Andy and I are talking about. So they trot out this guy who says, there's a horrible virus. And by the way, if you vaccinate people, it's going to make new variants, which we can't deal with. But the fact of the matter is already people are partly vaccinated. So that horse is out of the barn. And so now everybody should be even more scared because of the new variants, which are imaginary variants of the imaginary virus. And so now we should even do more things to protect ourselves. Like what? Maybe a new vaccine. So the whole thing is just confuses people and makes people believe even more, because you think, well, why would somebody warning us against these vaccines actually, you know, be sort of
exactly
sort of disinformation? Yeah. But that is exactly what's happening. These guys are grandmasters in chess, and most of us are either don't know there's a game or we're playing checkers.
Well, I bought into it, so I'm, you know, thanks. You know, I bit that one. Because, I mean, the guy, you know, he's an anti-vaxxer. I said, it's got to be true, right? Why would he, like you say, why would he be talking about it like this? So, what's his...
Because it's clear.
Go ahead. No, go ahead. Because it's clear that they know what they're doing, right? It's a controlled opposition, if you will, what you're arguing.
Patrick, I think I can answer this a little more directly, but let me just say also, if Dr. Bosch was legitimate, why did he not come out and report that the organizations he was involved in made hundreds of thousands of cases of polio caused by the vaccine in India and resulted in massive infertility in certain places in Africa? So he didn't tell us about those problems from the vaccine. He's only coming to talk about this, you know, hypothetical thing. And I agree fully with Tom, and I think the real purpose of his statement is that when people start or continue dying and it becomes more obvious that people are dying from the vaccines or who've only been vaccinated, they can say that it's not the vaccine. It's actually these dangerous variants of the virus. And basically so that no one then will then be concerned about the vaccine, and it'll reinforce the fear of the virus. And then even the people who are right now realize that it's about tyranny and something else because they think there's a virus that's just not very dangerous. Well, once you start seeing people dying all the time, then it's obviously it is a dangerous situation. And if you don't realize the truth of the virus, you're going to then think that now there is a dangerous virus. And then you're going to actually go along with these things and you're going to be further manipulated. And that is the real reason why this man came out and made these claims.
Fascinating. We're hearing about a Chinese or a California variant and all of this in Europe. And if viruses aren't alive, can they mutate and have a variable thing of them? I mean, is it just all this made up as well?
There is no virus.
There is no virus. Yeah,
variant of Cinderella. not to diss Cinderella, because that's a great story. But
wow,
it's just a story. show me the virus and then show me the isolated different virus with a different genome sequenced in the proper way, and we'll agree. And they don't have it.
They just don't have. So how many of souls like you are out there with this understanding that you do and painting this picture for people? Are there lots, a few, many? Do you?
Well, I think we put a number guys, on it, actually.
What's that?
Well, because Tom and I and Sally Fallon, we came together because we wanted to kind of just write up our position about the existence of the virus in terms that people can understand with scientific references. So we call it the Statement on Virus Isolation.
Yes.
And it's posted on our websites, and we'll give you the link below. And, you know, we haven't really advertised this too much, but we did allow people to put their signature if they agree. And we have now just about 6,500 signatures over a 2 or 3 week period. So we could safely say that at least that many people who have heard our analysis and our message also have arrived at the same conclusion and agree with us. And I'll tell you that in the recent weeks, there are more and more doctors and scientists
yes.
who are finally willing to look at this issue and read the papers and realize that there really is no scientific basis behind this germ theory, and that we will never find out how to really achieve health for ourselves and for humanity unless we put this aside.
This would be more a spiritual, kind of philosophical to end, a note to end on. But I wonder why you have theories and why it's so difficult for souls in a body these days to just let go of the idea that something can hurt them. They just want to hang on. A lot of people want to hang on to the idea that there is something there that can get me, and maybe it's just, I don't know, subconscious lifetime.
Oh, it's a spell, you know.
What's it, Doc? Dr. Cohen?
It's a spell.
It's a spell. Yeah. Just a spell. Yeah. Fairy dust. I mean,
it's a very well organized and engineered
sure.
spell.
Yeah, I know.
Using technology and intensive planning and all of the tools of propaganda.
And I'm not being critical of them because, you know, I mean, every 98% of the media is selling this story. So, I mean, you can understand. And they grew up with it, right? They grew up with it with doctors. And well, you two are fun to talk to. Thanks. I had a good time. I hope you did. Did you guys have fun? Is it all right? We did okay?
No, you know, we hate this, Patrick.
What's that?
We're tired of like saying the same thing over and over again. But we do enjoy teaming up in our misery. We have owe you gratitude for allowing
right.
us to share our misery in this pursuit.
It was great fun. So before you go, give yourself...
Misery loves company.
Misery loves company. And what people should know is that you can't make a living doing talk shows. So you all have to have a house payment. So let's help you with that. So what are some ways that you have some influx so people maybe can support you? Dr. Cohen, you have some great products, powders, on our website, One Radio Network, that I love. The Ashatiba, the Burdock, wow, turmeric. And he's got these powders that you've dehydrated and put in Myron glass, and you can put on your food. And that's a way that you have a little business there, right? Your powders?
Yeah, we got all kinds of things. Go to drtomcowan.com.
Yeah.
And everybody should sign up for our Subscribestar and Andy's, I don't know what it's called, new channel to be.
Webinar.
Go to Andy's website. There's a some sort of subscription service, right? Something like that. And so that everybody do that, because we got to figure this out here.
You're as bad as I am, you're a Luddite boy, Dr. Cohen. I love you, Doctor. So your website, drkaufman.com, is that what it is? drkaufman.com.
It's Andrew Kaufman, MD.com.
And what kind of service can people subscribe to?
Yeah. Well, first, let me say that Tom and I actually both sell Shilajit, the same product, which is very high quality trace mineral supplement. And that is one thing that can help a little bit remove some of the toxic heavy metals. But what I really wanted to talk about is that I'm introducing a new membership service where twice a month I'm going to give webinars where I'll have guests on, I'll give presentations, but mostly I'll be available to answer questions and even have a back and forth interaction so that you can learn how to deal with your health problems. You can certainly ask me extra questions about viruses and germ theory, and we'll have a real open dialogue where I'll be able to spend the time. And if you will sign up and support me in that, it will allow me to keep providing all of this free information with all the interviews and other work that I do. So I really appreciate it.
Because your children do eat as well. You know, every few hours they do get hungry. It's amazing how that works like that. I don't understand how it works like that. So if you were in a courtroom, could you think you could prove to a jury that you're right?
That would be absolutely easy.
Would it be easy to do?
In this case, yeah, because, you know, I actually, in my career, I've done a lot of expert witness work and mostly related to mental health.
You're a psychiatrist.
And psychology.
Yeah, you're a psychiatrist. Yeah.
Correct. And, you know, when you make those opinions, there is nothing you can hang your hat on. Like, there's not a blood test, there's not a x-ray, right, that you can say it's all really your medical opinion and judgment. But with this issue, we've got a clear scientific finding. You know, either there's something or there's nothing. Mm-hmm. And so there's really no room for judgment and opinion. It's very cut and dry. And all you have to do is communicate that, you know, to the people. And as long as they can understand it, they'll realize right away what's what.
So if you had a prosecuting attorney, if he didn't have evidence, you know, habeas corpus, show me the body of evidence to prove that there was a virus, the jury would go your way, you're arguing. They'd have to, right?
The burden
of proof
is
on them. On them, yeah.
Of course. Of course, because the person who makes the claim has to support the claim.
Yeah. Show me the body. Habeas corpus. Dr. Cowan, do you have a kitty there that's talking to you?
No, that's me.
Is that you? I can hear the cat. All right, you two, thanks a lot. It is drtomcowan.com and then andrewkaufman.com. I so appreciate you coming on the show. I had great fun, and you can pass on these links to everybody. This will be up on BitChute, and you can do the thing. And so thanks a lot to both of you. I appreciate it. I love you both. Thanks for your work. Take care of yourself.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You too.
Dr. Cowan, Dr. Kaufman. Well, there you go. Well, show me the virus. I will see you on Friday. We're going to do a show about something. I'm going to take the day off tomorrow. I hope you enjoyed this last 90 minutes. I think they did a great job. And this would be something really fun that you could pass on to friends and family, and maybe to help them to, you know, come around a little bit, to not be so frightened by things that are theoretically flying around in the air. I didn't bring this up there, and I can talk more about it on Friday. And I will talk more about it on Friday. But I have, for what it's worth, your host here, I've been looking at the soul, who I am and you are, body-mind paradigm very closely and intimately for a long time, especially the last 10 years as I chose to create some things like irritable bowel syndrome and sciatica and heartburn. And it was kind of like my karma dharma to look at it from a spiritual level, and not just because I knew that there was just no way I was going to take a bunch of stuff, take this or that, or go to a chiropractor. I just knew it because I tried, and, you know, I just knew it was like my karma dharma to look at it from a spiritual level. And now I know why, so I could see how it worked, see, not read about it, but see how it worked, so I could then share it with you. I mean, because we all do stuff, and that's what we do for a living. You know, we come up with ideas, and we come things, and we share them, and those of us in this kind of business, in the health business and things, and, you know, that's what we do. So I can just say from a spiritual level, I can absolutely, for what it's worth, I can't prove it, that there's absolutely nothing that can hurt me unless I invite it in. Just can't. And if something comes in the form of a thought or an idea or a theory, a virus is a theory, it's up to me as soul whether or not to accept it or not. If I do, it's very simple. If I do accept it, then it's in there, and then it's going to affect the body. If I don't accept it, and this starts spiritually, mentally, emotionally, it's not there. Now, if I go to Burger Doodle, and I'm just using that, and there was something in the Burger Doodle that was like a toxin, I'm not evolved enough yet to deal with that at the moment and say, oh, there was a toxin in there. I'm working on that one. Let's maybe in the future. But those things will come out, right, by detoxification, sweating, going to the bathroom and all that. But I did let it in, maybe unknowingly, but I did let it in, eating it at Burger Doodle, maybe a glyphosate. But for what that's worth, I believe that we are getting to the point as we grow spiritually, because we're having these conversations, that we are, boom, 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 changing our DNA, RNA, EPA, CIA, whatever is all in there, magically, because that's what we do to not allow things in or change things so it doesn't hurt us. And I think this is what's going to go on with electromagnetic fields, because these people who are into 5G, 6G, 12G, they're going to keep bombing us because this is what they do. So don't worry about it. You can figure out how to just not affect you. You don't want to move under a cell phone tower and be crazy. You be prudent and, you know, be careful with your cell phones. And, you know, we have great tools like the Blue Shield and, you know, to help block it. But at the end of the day, I think it's going to be a spiritual awakening. So the 5G, 6G, 12G, whatever they come up with, doesn't hurt us. It's going to be up to us to just know that we are soul, we are and sparks of God, and that's it. Can't hurt us unless we believe it can and let it in. Dr. Richard Massey was on yesterday. Well, I'll do this more on Friday. I'll get into it more on Friday. All right, so I love you all very much. Thank you. It was an honor to be here with you. Please pass on this link to everyone that you care about. What we'll do is you'll be able to, we'll rerun the show, and then we'll get it up on BitChute, and then we'll have a link. We haven't quite got to the point where we have all our videos on One Radio Network, so you can pass them along, but I think the video would be fun, but we'll have the audio as well. And send these to friends and family, this show, so maybe it would help lessen their anxiety about some mythical virus that just ain't there. It just isn't there. And could help them, not just with Corona, but other things that may come up, and who knows what these people are going to come up with. As Mark Twain once said, it's not what we know that's a problem. It's not what we don't know which is a problem. It's not what we don't know is a problem. It's what we know that just ain't so. I love you all very much. I do. It's an honor. I will see you on Friday. May the blessings be.
We are listener supported. One Radio Network.